There are 2 hours that that's required for this, and usually when the group stays longer, I do 1 hour separately and 1 hour afterwards. So I can only tell you the conclusions of the other hours I can't give you and tell you where you can read it, and that makes it inadequate, but if you come for 2.5 weeks, so some things are going to get shortchanged. First of all, just a few remarks on background. A great deal has been written and said about the uniqueness of the Holocaust. I urge you to be very skeptical of this idea. I urge you to be very cautious of this idea. When you emphasize an event's uniqueness, inevitably, what you do is you detach it from the rest of history. And you deprive it of its appropriate historical context. And that is a very serious intellectual move. And if it's a mistake, it's a gigantic mistake. So I urge you to be very cautious and skeptical of the idea that the Holocaust was really unique. The suffering was horrific. But the Chmielnicki pogroms, one of the things that the Polish Cossacks did was to take a pregnant woman, slit open her out of an abdomen, take out the fetus, and sew up inside a live cat. Anything you saw today worse than that? Do you have a horror meter where you can evaluate the horror of a death? I don't think that death by crucifixion, which was the standard Roman way for killing people who were condemned to death, is pleasant either. And being disemboweled by a Roman soldier, and the Roman soldiers killed men, women, and children, Josephus says 2 million Jews were killed by the Romans. You say, well, this is three times as many, therefore it's three times as worse. The percentage of the Jewish population that was killed was 1/3. Some estimates put the same percentage killed during the Crusades. Our sources tell us that in 3 days, this week's Parsha, in 3 days of darkness, 80% of the Jewish population in Egypt was killed. That's much, much worse than the Holocaust. So if you're talking about our records, our history is seen from the point of view of our records, the Holocaust is certainly not worse than those events. And the impact on the people, as a culture, as a religion, the destruction of the Second Temple was much worse. Much worse. Today, about 250 out of the 613 commandments are in operation. The cultural dislocation, losing your land, losing the majority of your commandments, losing your temple and the pilgrimage festivals, ultimately losing your Sanhedrin, which means losing your central authority, not to mention losing your king. Existing as a disorganized, dispersed set of tiny minorities, if anything, the impact of those events is much worse than the Holocaust. Maybe the precise psychology of the criminal is different, the bureaucratization of evil. But I don't think that that's a very big element in our historiography. How we see our history, the lessons of our history, the particular identity of the enemy is of interest, but not a central interest. If it's a matter of how could Jews have to face so much terrible suffering, this is not the first time this has happened in our history, which means that the intellectual resources for explaining suffering, which exist in the tradition, can very well be relevant to this event as well. Not to assume that because it's supposedly unique, that therefore nothing in the tradition can be relevant to it. Now, there really are two distinct questions. One question is, how is it possible, appropriate, in a world run by God, for innocent people to suffer? righteous people to suffer. This problem has nothing to do with the Holocaust. The Holocaust impresses us because 6 million people died in 6 years on one continent. Just imagine spreading out that suffering over 6 continents and spreading it out over 600 years. Would anyone have noticed? Would there be symposia on the subject? Classes on the subject? Museums dedicated to the subject? Nobody would have even thought of it. But from the point of view of God running the world, it makes absolutely no difference whether the suffering is compressed into a small area of space and time, or whether it's spread out. What difference does that make? Indeed, the amount of suffering makes no difference altogether. If one child stubs his toe without an explanation, that's already a complaint against God. Each pain is a complaint. Either you have a scheme for explaining pains, which can apply pain by pain to explain why it's possible for innocent people to suffer, or you don't. If you do, then you see if it applies event by event, one by one, to each of the people throughout history who have suffered. The fact that they are crowded together or spread out makes absolutely no difference. Now, the problem of suffering is as old as the Torah. The book of Job was written by Moses. Abraham protests against the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. Maybe there'll be innocent people there. The problem of innocent people suffering is as old as the Torah, and there are dozens and dozens of reasons why people suffer. I have a review of those in my book, The Reformed Soul. It's a chapter in that book, and in many other books this subject is treated. This is not a new subject. I'll just mention a couple, just one-liners, because that's not my main focus tonight. People who are guilty, people who have committed crimes, suffering, a certain level of suffering is appropriate for them. The problem that bothers us is innocent people suffering, not just every suffering. Righteous people suffering, not just every suffering. If there is any guilt, so already the problem loses much of its force. In terms of external values, it certainly loses its force. No one would be upset if Al Capone falls down the stairs and ends up paralyzed from the waist down. Some people are upset that he doesn't fall down the stairs and end up paralyzed from the waist down. So the extent to which there is guilt is the extent to which the problem is not a serious problem. Of course, the critic will immediately point out that there were 1.5 million children. The poor critic doesn't have a Jewish education. If he did, he would know that it is an integral Jewish belief that there is such a thing as reincarnation. I took a few of you through the sources in the Chumash and the Tanakh on that subject. Reincarnation means that this child, this soul, which is embodied at this moment in a child, had any number of lifetimes in which it engaged in any number of different activities. So if you ask, how could a child be guilty? The answer is, very easily. It's not difficult. This child could be the latest stage of a soul that had many previous histories. In order for there to be free will, innocent people must suffer. And wicked people must prosper. Otherwise, your free choices are really just going to be selfish choices. If the good people always do well and the bad people always get hit, then you'll be good just because it pays. In order to make any principled decisions at all, to choose the good because it's good, not because it pays, often the good must not pay. And must not pay means that when you choose the good, you're going to pay for it. You're not going to succeed thereby, but you're going to lose. Lose in physical terms, lose in material terms, lose in this worldly terms. So if we are put here to make free decisions between good and evil, innocent people must suffer and wicked people must prosper. So the suffering of people to us is not a strange subject. Certain amount of suffering is due to guilt, even though that's not complete from the Jewish point of view, but from the external point of view, that already short-circuits the objection. And the rest of it is due to factors like free will, which are necessary for the world to fulfill its purpose. Now, as far as individuals are concerned, what we do is take each person, indeed take each moment in each person's life and ask, do we have reasons that could explain why this person at this moment is suffering? And the answer is yes, without difficulty. There's individual guilt of the person in his lifetime, there's reincarnation, there's free will, there are other such principles. Explaining each pain, one by one, is not a crushing objection to the Jewish tradition. And as I said, if you want to see sources, you can look at my chapter on suffering in the Reformed Soul. But there's another question. The form that the suffering takes. Sometimes there is a national tragedy. A tragedy that isolates the nation, and you can see that it's directed particularly at this nation. Other times, the same number of people could suffer. And suffer just as horribly. But without the event being a national tragedy. Let's take the Black Death in Europe. In 10 years, 40% of Europe died. A lot of Jews died. Okay, we were more hygienic than other people. Instead of being 40% of our population, it was 20% of our population. But 20% of your population to die in 10 years is a gigantic catastrophe. But it wasn't a national tragedy. Because the whole of Europe suffered the same fate. A Jew couldn't say that we're being punished as Jews, as a nation, for some kind of failure, because it was hitting the whole environment as well. Or if you have a variety of different disasters, and each one affects a local community, that also won't have the structure, the organization of a national event, even though a phenomenal number of Jews might, God forbid, be suffering under those that conglomeration of individual local events. So really, when people suffer, there are two different questions. One question is, why did this person at this moment suffer this pain? And then you explain each pain with guilt, and in particular reincarnation, and or free will, or other principles of that kind. And then you have a case where the suffering takes the form of a national tragedy. And then you have to ask, what is the message in the fact that it was a national tragedy? Now, the first thing to recognize is that there is an enormous difference between God causing an event versus God allowing an event to take place. Sodom and Gomorrah were destroyed by fire and brimstone raining down upon them from heaven. That God did. The city of Dresden was bombed continuously round the clock by the Allies to the extent that the atmosphere caught on fire. 135,000 people were killed in the space of a few days. More than Nagasaki and more than Hiroshima. It was an atomic bomb, so nobody cares. And believe me, I think they deserved it. I'm not offering pity for the Germans. But there, God didn't kill the people of Dresden. God allowed the Allies the ability to work their will so that they would be able to bomb Dresden and use it as a tool to end the war. So you have to distinguish between events that God causes versus events that God allows to happen. The Holocaust was caused by the free will choices of the Germans. The Germans were not made into tools. Their free will was not taken away. There's ample literature on how willing, no, enthusiastic they were in joining the ranks of killing Jews. It's an event that God allowed to happen. That itself needs to be explained. It needs to be explained. If God allows it to happen, then he is an accomplice to the event. That's true. He could have stopped it. Indeed, those of you who study with me know it's a little more than that. A human being makes a free decision, and God causes the world to carry it out, so he's even more intimately involved. But it is the root of the event is the free decisions of human beings. In this case, not that God caused it to happen. Now, Moshe Meiselman, who was one of my teachers and one of, I think, the significant thinkers in the generation, wrote a pamphlet, which he personally published, which is not available, unfortunately. And he offered some of the following reflections. I'm leaving a lot out, but this is what I want to, for your purpose. Can we explain suffering or not? Here you find a blatant contradiction in the Tanakh, in the Bible, and a blatant contradiction in the Talmudic sources. On the one hand, you have the Book of Lamentations, Eicha, which says clearly that the destruction of the temple was due to our failures, due to our transgressions, our sins. On the other hand, you have the Book of Job, which discusses the issue, and a great deal is encapsulated there, but it's impossible to understand. It's impossible to read, it's impossible to understand. So, Job makes it sound like it's really beyond us to understand the answer, and Lamentations makes it sound like the answer is straightforward. And the same thing is true in the Talmud. On the one hand, the Talmud asks, why was the first temple destroyed? And he gives a list of particular transgressions. Why was the second temple destroyed? You must have heard a dozen times because it causes hatred. And on the other hand, the Talmud says, Ein biyadenu, we do not have in our hands the ability to explain the suffering of the righteous and the prosperity of the wicked. So, what's the truth? Can we explain this or can we not explain? Says Meiselman, it depends upon which kind of suffering you're talking about. Whether you're talking about the suffering of the individual or the suffering of the community. The national event of suffering. And he bases this on a Rashi. You say the Shema, you say the Shema twice a day. It's very interesting, in the first paragraph of the Shema, there is no promise of any response to your actions. You're simply told to keep certain mitzvos. Doesn't say that if you do well, things will go well, if you do ill, things will go ill. None of that is mentioned. In the second paragraph, you have some detail that if you do well, things will go well, and if you do ill, things will go ill. What's the difference between the paragraphs? Says Rashi, the first paragraph is in the singular. Second paragraph is in the plural. To the individual, no promises are made. Because there are too many factors that impinge upon an individual's life for us to be able to see a correspondence between this person's spiritual record on the one hand and his lot in life on the other hand. There may be a correspondence, but it's impossible for us to see it. And when I said that there are reasons to explain individual suffering, what I meant was that there are reasons in the abstract. We know the kinds of things that are responsible for suffering. But if you ask about a particular case, very often you will not be able to say which particular causes are relevant to that case. Around the turn of the 20th century, the early 20th century in China, everyone died of heart attack. Everyone. Because when a person died, and a doctor was called, they had to fill out the death certificate, put his ear to the person's chest, the heart wasn't beating, so the heart definitely stopped, so it's a heart attack. They didn't have any way to diagnose why the person died, so every death certificate was filled out with heart attack. That doesn't mean they all died of a miracle. There are lots of reasons why people die. And we assume that one or another of the reasons was, for each person, kidney failure, lung failure, you know, accident. But in their case, they couldn't tell which the reasons were. So, when the Talmud says we cannot explain the sufferings of individuals, it means take a particular individual and ask, why is he suffering? The answer will be, I have 25 reasons why people suffer, but I don't know which ones apply to him. But, when you come to the community, the nation for sure, and then I don't know where the cutoff point is, what's called a community. There, not only is there a correspondence between national performance and national existence, but it's a visible performance. It's a visible connection. It's a connection that we can, in principle, discover. And that's why the Book of Lamentations offers its reasons, and why the Talmud offers its reasons for the destruction of the temples. Because national tragedies, in principle, are there to communicate a message to us, a message of how we are supposed to react to them. Maimonides writes in the Laws of Fasts, Laws of Fast Days. What is the purpose of a fast day? Some of you remember when I spoke to you 2 weeks ago. If your helpful, friendly anthropologist tells you that the purpose of a fast day is to punish yourself so as to avoid divine punishment, reassign him to Africa someplace. Tell him that there's no connection to the Jewish people. Maimonides says, the purpose of a fast day is to cause a focus on the tragedies that are facing the people so that we can analyze what communal failure is responsible and take measures to improve. A normal healthy person does not undergo significant suffering if he doesn't eat for 14 hours. Eat or drink for 14 hours. But you don't forget it. When you're fasting, you're totally conscious of the fact that you're not eating and drinking today. That's the point. The point is to be mentally focused, and there should be some kind of communal focus, so that there could be an analysis of what failures led to the tragedy, so that measures could be taken. If that's the definition of a fast day, then the Torah is telling us, you can do it. You can discover it. I don't say there couldn't be exceptions, but the general rule is that for communal tragedies, it is a challenge, and it is a possibility to analyze, to discover the failures that led to it, and to take steps to rectify it. Now, this perspective, I mentioned to some of you, I'm going to repeat it, Meisman points out, is epitomized by Queen Esther. Queen Esther expresses this in pretty clear terminology. When Mordechai discovers the decree of annihilation against the Jewish people, he puts on sackcloth and ashes, and he runs through the streets, yelling and screaming, crying. Esther sends a messenger to Mordechai, and charges the messenger to ask him the following question. Mazeh ve'al mazeh. What is this? And what's it based on? As we would say, why is this? The two questions are different. One question is, what are the forces that are arrayed against us? Political forces, military forces, economic forces, psychological forces, ethnic forces. Who are our enemies? Do we have any friends? What kind of leverage do we have? What's the situation on the ground? That's mazeh. The al-mazeh is, what does divine providence want in this situation? Why are we facing this situation? Nothing happens by chance. And since it doesn't happen by chance, there must be some divine message in it. What kind of failure we're guilty of, and what could be done to remedy it. She asks these two questions, and that is our responsibility. Our responsibility is to ask both of these questions. Now, there's one principle that underlies the whole existence of the Jewish people, which is central to every case of answering why a tragedy befalls the Jewish people. And that principle, Meisman says, is we don't belong here. We don't belong here. We spoke about the survival of the Jewish people as an unexplained event, as a miracle. We talked about 2,000 years of small minority status, where any other culture, group of people would have
disintegrated, gone to pieces, assimilated. We spoke about the preceding 1,000 years. A tiny, insignificant group of people with a unique, as we said, ideology at the crossroads of 3 continents, stubbornly and successfully resisting all of the cultural trends and maintaining its outlandish, prophetic ideology, values, worldview. The message of that analysis is, we don't belong here. The forces of nature, that means the forces of psychology and sociology and economics and anthropology and ethnic development and myth formation and all the rest, those forces should have wiped us out. How did we survive? Only because of divine providence. The Talmud's way of putting it for the last 2,000 years is, if you put a lamb among 70 wolves, you don't expect to find even wool left over. So the picture of the Jewish people in history is a gigantic wall of water being held back by an invisible dam, leaving us a little dry ground on which we can carry out our activities. But without that wall, we should be drowned. History should have drowned us. There is a constant standing miracle of Jewish survival. No, you're already getting exquisite special treatment. Something has to be done to earn it. And if the scales of merit fall too low, then cracks appear in the dam. Cracks appearing in the dam means that the forces of nature, which are already poised, already primed to destroy us, are simply given their way. It doesn't require God to initiate a blow. It just means that God relaxes his control of those who are all too ready to tear us to pieces. So, the national tragedy has to be understood as a symptom of a failure, a national failure in, or communal failure, as I say. I don't know where the cutoff line is between the individual and the nation. A continent counts surely as a communal failure. Perhaps a city counts as a communal failure. Neighborhood probably not. I don't know where the cutoff is, but Europe as certainly counts as a communal failure. And that's where the cause has to be sought. And this means that the analysis is in the same terms of the analysis which we have been using for 3,000 more years. This is not an event that requires rewriting Jewish philosophy, as some superficial thinkers would lead you to believe. But rather, it's a question of applying the old norms, but applying them with your eyes open, without prejudice and without ideological commitments. Sometimes the question is put like this. I hope you can see through this without my guidance, but in case you have trouble, I'll give you the guidance. But let me put the question boldly. The Jews of Europe were nice people. Do we have any reason to think that the Jews of Europe were vicious people, nasty people, really trying to take over the world, really poisoning the wells and killing Jews and Christians, really stealing Christian children and using their blood for matzahs? No, right? The Jewish people lie more than other people, cheat more than other people, steal more than other people, beat up other people more? Probably not. So it means the Jewish people were basically good people. Basically nice people, civilized, polite, kind, considerate people, basically. Okay, we had our criminals too. Eastern Europe, where there was a Jewish mafia. But on the whole, the Jewish population was certainly not worse than the other populations of Europe. And we would like to think, perhaps even somewhat better. How then is it conceivable to say that guilt, is responsible for the Holocaust? How is it conceivable? When it is clear that they weren't guilty.
Do you detect anything naive in this question? Anything superficial in this question? What did I cite in analyzing the innocence of the Jewish community in Europe? Did they cheat? Did they steal? Did they kill people or murder people? Did they work to take over the world? That's what I cited, right? What did I leave out? Just a little thing, the Torah, the whole of the Torah. I didn't mention Shabbos, or Kashrus, or charity, 10% of your income, try that on your friends and neighbors. Or the laws of modesty, prayer, Torah study, holidays. I didn't mention any of that. Why doesn't the person asking the question take that into account? Why isn't that even part of the question? Can you guess why? Because the person asking the question doesn't keep Shabbos. Because the person asking the question doesn't keep Kashrus. Because the person asking the question doesn't keep the holidays. Because the person in class who's asking the question doesn't study Torah. Indeed, the person asking the question doesn't study Torah. But then isn't there something, some kind of logical glitch in the question? The question is supposed to be thrown at us. The question is, you believe in God. How can you explain how God would do this? The questioner doesn't believe in God. He's given it up long ago. He likes cheeseburgers. But he says to you, you believe in God. How can you explain this when the people were really good people? The answer is, if you ask me to answer it from God's point of view, God cares about more than just murder and stealing and fraud. God gave us a book in which he laid down his rules for living. Presumably he cares about all of them. So the way you put the question is totally incompetent. What you ought to ask is, to what extent was the population of Europe living up to the laws of the Torah? Maybe then you can gain some insight into whether guilt is a relevant category here. Now, as a matter of fact, in between the wars, between the First and Second World War, more than 50% of the Jewish population of Europe was not religious. If you saw a fiddler on the roof, put that in your imagination 100 years ago or 150 years ago. It does not portray Europe between the wars. And there was an accelerating defection from Torah observance. And not only in the big cities, but on the countryside as well. The Torah observance of Europe was in an accelerating condition of disintegration. In the ghettos set up by the Nazis, and to a certain extent even in the death camps, but mostly in the ghettos, Lucy Davidovich in her book, The War Against the Jews, which, if you're going to read one book about the Holocaust, that's it. That is the single best book about the Holocaust. She documents that every attempt was made to maintain the semblance of normal life. In the ghettos, which means you're talking about conditions of backbreaking labor, periodic transports off to the death camps. There were art exhibitions and poetry readings and musical performances and classes on every subject you could imagine. Philosophy, foreign languages, mathematics, sociology, history, cultural life to the extent possible. Now, if you're one of the secular critics, you celebrate this as the resistance of the spirit under very difficult circumstances, still expressing noble, sublime values. But you could look at it another way. Who is authoring? Who is organizing the systematic execution, annihilation of the Jewish people? The most cultured, the most so-called civilized, the most scientific, the most scholarly, the most creative nation in Western Europe, Germany. At a certain point, wouldn't it be appropriate to stop and reflect, whose culture am I celebrating? When I have my poetry readings, and I have my musical performances, and I have my art exhibitions, and I study philosophy and mathematics, and the rest, whose culture am I celebrating? Western culture, of which Germany was probably the single most
powerful expression.
And they're murdering us. Couldn't there be a lesson here? That maybe that culture, maybe that civilization, really has something rotten at its base?
Those of you who are in the Chumash will remember what Avraham Avinu said to Abimelech. There's no fear of God in this place. Even though Abimelech spoke about innocence and righteousness and integrity. And Abraham said, I know about your innocence, your righteousness, your integrity, but you don't fear God, and therefore you'll kill me for my wife.
How about rethinking the fundamentals?
No, there was a tremendous effort made to turn a blind eye to this message. After all, the Holocaust didn't happen overnight. It happened in slow stages. And according to many, Hitler Yimach Shemo himself was surprised at each step that he took that there wasn't much response. There was no international outrage. There was no international resistance. People sort of turned a blind eye. He himself didn't. It wasn't a matter of a three-month campaign. It took years for the final solution to be formulated in entirety, and it took more years to put it into action. Those years gave the Jewish populations a chance to think, what's going on here? What is the source of what's going on? But there was precious little rethinking. Yes, there were some Baalei Tshuva in the camps. There were some. But, as you know, it was a tiny, insignificant minority. L'chon HaBasin says in an essay, in the late 19th and early 20th century, you had something new in the Jewish people. He says it's new altogether. Maybe in the Hellenistic period, 2300 years before, you had a similar thing. But certainly, the first time in 2000 years, you had a new idea. People left Torah because they believed they found something better. Christian pogroms broke people, broke whole communities, no question about it. But there, if a person gave up and became Christian, it's because he just couldn't take being kicked around. And frankly, thank God I've never been kicked around like that, so I don't know how much I could take. Hard to judge a person who, under that kind of pressure, and kicked around is probably too gentle. People systematically killed and forced expulsions of them. So, a certain number of people, a certain percentage of the population, breaks under that kind of pressure. But here, in the end of the 19th, the beginning of the 20th century, you have people who volunteered to leave Judaism because they believed they found something better. Socialism, communism, and secular Zionism. Those were the ideologies that masses of Jews embraced, believing that they had found something more true, more beautiful, more ideal, more sublime, more moral, more good, more righteous, more just than the Torah. Now this is a kind of awesome. That was a unique defection. A defection unlike the history of the previous 2,000 plus years. The oppressor in the 20th century was also unique. The oppressor of the 20th century, the first one, since Purim, who did not care what ideas are in your head. All he cared about was whether you had one Jewish grandparent. Hitler didn't kill Jews because of what they believed. It didn't matter what you believed. You could offer a pledge of allegiance to become a Nazi. It wouldn't help. They'd kill you anyway. So when Jews committed themselves to false ideas and volunteered to leave Torah, the oppressor said, I don't care what ideas you have in your head. Doesn't interest me. I'm murdering the body. Your head has become irrelevant. You could see a kind of correspondence there. Now, in most people's minds, especially the secular critics, there's a gigantic objection to this analysis. And the objection is, if God's allowing the Holocaust was a punishment, allowing cracks in the dam so that the waters of nature can overwhelm a community because of communal desertion of Torah life, Why then did that happen in America? If you compare American Jews with the Jews in Europe, okay, let's say 55% in Europe were not religious and it was accelerating. That doesn't touch the American scene. The American scene was much, much worse than that. So if it's a punishment for deserting the laws of the Torah, surely America should have been hit, at least in addition to Europe, maybe in place of Europe. And since America wasn't hit, that proves that the analysis in terms of guilt is a mistake. I want you to know there are circles of supposedly intelligent, thoughtful people for whom this is a crushing rebuttal and shows that the analysis is not right. This objection could be answered by an intelligent 11-year-old. This is not a crushing rebuttal at all. Any film kid knows the answer to this question. And the answer is, God has different standards for different people. God does not judge each person by the same standard. The standard by which you're judged is apportioned to what could be reasonably expected from you. The Talmud says God is exacting with those who are close to him to a hair's breadth. That's for those who are close to him, but not for everybody. The Briskerov epitomized this idea by a comment on the book of Jonah. God tells Jonah to go to Nineveh. He books passage to Tarshish. So there's a storm, and you know the story. The storm threatens to overthrow the boat. They throw him overboard, and the storm abates, and they go sailing out to port with no difficulty. Ask the Briskerov, who are the sailors on the boat? What kind of people are they? The book is explicit. They're all idol worshippers. They're all idol worshippers. So ask the Briskerov, isn't this a little out of proportion? Okay, Jonah's doing something wrong, but he's a prophet. He is the cream of Jewish spirituality. Can you really compare him? Not only compare him to the idol worshipping sailors, but you treat him worse than these idol worshippers? Where's the balance in it? Says the Briskerov, God's expectations for a Jewish prophet are wildly different from his expectations for non-Jewish idol worshippers. How much can you expect of a person who grows up in an idol worshipping society? Can't expect every person to be Abraham. Whereas a person who's a prophet is expected to do better. So we certainly do not have a single standard by which everyone is measured. And therefore it is impossible to tell who's doing better vis-a-vis what God expects for him. And indeed, if you look at America, if you know the history of the American Jewish community, you can easily see that God's standards for them must have been very low. Exactly how low is impossible for us to describe or calculate, but it must have been very low. Who came to America from Europe? People who wanted to escape pogroms and starvation. But remember, the majority of the Jews did not come to America. They stayed behind. And they didn't all starve to death. And they didn't all die in pogroms. So it wasn't exactly emigrate or die. So who came? The ones who had the least connection to their Jewish roots. Because everybody knew that America is the trade for Medina, the trade country, where there were no great yeshivas, no great Hasidic groups, no great kehillos, no great Jewish organized communities. And so the people who came to America were the dregs of European religious Jewry. There were a few exceptions, but the vast majority, those who came in the 1880s and 1890s and 1900s and 1910s, these were people who were the dregs of the society. A whole generation thereafter was lost. My father, Olam Shalom, among them. The story that was repeated hundreds of thousands of times. The child is 8 years old and he goes to Cheder and the Rebbe is teaching him something and the Rebbe himself is a person who couldn't get a job doing anything else. And the child asks a question and the Rebbe gives him a slap and says, read. And the child runs out and never comes back. Why? Because the teacher's in ignorance. It's not his fault. He doesn't know what he's teaching. Couldn't get a job at a knitting factory, so took a job teaching children. A community like that, what do you expect from them? So the fact that there were more religious Jews in Europe than there were in America is irrelevant to the question, did Europe represent a colossal spiritual failure at that time, and thereby justify God's reducing the level of protection and allowing the forces arrayed against us to have their will and cause a great destruction? And the answer is, from everything we could tell, there's no reason to say not. You certainly cannot prove the opposite. So this is the way to see the failure, to see the Holocaust. The fact that the Holocaust took the form of a national tragedy. We're not now talking about why individuals suffered. I told you that's a separate question and a separate answer. But why was it in the form of a national tragedy? To alert us to a national failure. And that is something which we have to take into account and think in terms of our own existence and our own communities to see how we can do the best that we can to live up to whatever expectations God has for us. I have about 4 minutes to answer questions. Yeah.
Does understanding the concept of suffering has to do with changing the definition, or not changing, but adjusting the definition of just and fair?
No. Many people have tried this out. You won't find this in any Jewish sources. And you won't find it in any capital J Jewish sources. Any real Jewish sources. None of us will say that you don't know what good is, and you don't know what evil is, and you don't know what fear is. Those are all divine ideas. And divine ideas could be very different from our ideas. And therefore, we aren't even equipped to raise the question. We aren't equipped to even discuss the subject. In all of the hundreds of citations of this problem, that way out is never taken. And it's not taken for a simple reason. Because the Torah, written and oral, was presented to us as a communication from God. We are not sneaking a glance at God's private records. If we did that, then we could say, listen, he wrote them for himself, didn't write them for us. Who knows whether we're competent to understand them? That would be understandable. But if God communicates with us, that he's got to do so in a way that we can be presumed to understand. Yes, there may be hidden depth in addition that we don't understand. But to say that the whole concept is a blank, you know, maybe when God says tov, he means buttercups. And when he says ra, he means dust. So therefore, tov and ra, good and evil, are really quite different from what you thought. And anything that promotes buttercups is good, and anything that promotes dust is bad. So why are you worried about suffering? Who says suffering is bad? There is no such approach. When the verse in Psalm says, "Tamu ru'u ki tov Hashem," literally, taste and see that God is good. You cannot look at a tragedy and say, "Oh well, you know, by good, God needs pink, and look, there was a lot of pink, so that means it was good." No, that's not a way out. No Jewish source takes that way out.
There's no absolute definition.
What's that?
There's no absolute definition.
You're taking this for my words?
No, I'm just questioning.
Oh, that's a new question. There is an absolute definition, but that doesn't mean we can state it with absolute precision. And by absolute means that there's a definition, the definition is true, and somebody disagrees with it is wrong. Yes, there is a definition. Because good, after all, I'm encapsulating 2 hours worth of work in 1 minute, and I have to run and teach in the other place. Good is an English word. This is going to sound terrible, but I can. If I had more time, I could justify it. But I've got to make the point in a vivid way. Good is an English word. We own that word. It's our word. And therefore, the only thing relevant to defining it is the way in which we use the word. And what I have to say to Chinese people is, either you have a word that corresponds to our meaning, in which case you have a concept of good, or you have no word that corresponds to our meaning, in which case you don't have a concept of good. Because good, G-O-O-D, is my word. You may have other concepts, and you may do other things, but they're not good. Because good is an English word, and therefore it's an English concept. So either you have a concept that's translatable, or you don't. And if you don't, there's no such thing as Chinese good, which really means boiling babies in oil. That's just a
blatant contradiction.
Yeah.
I can only think of pushing this question towards individuals. For example, we get people in our Bible course who would have lots of faith in Hashem and carry on learning Torah no matter what, and unfortunately perish, and their children would sometimes not believe in Hashem and survive the war. Could that be to do with what happens in the next? I don't know, I'm asking. Could that be?
It could be, but you shouldn't start with that kind of a question. The truth is, I just answered that question. The person who believes and dies versus the person who doesn't believe and survives, is that any different from comparing Europe to America? Isn't that the same question over there?
Yeah.
So this person who believes, maybe God expects from him 50% better performance, and for the one who doesn't believe, they have their lowest expectations. He's the sailor on Jonah's ship. The question doesn't get off the ground. Well, if you have the right perspective, the question doesn't get off the ground. Yeah.
You said before that sometimes God does things that he actually causes, and sometimes he lets things happen.
Right.
I want to ask you, what is the practical difference? The bottom line is, like, God letting something happen, he's still the same outcome's happening.
The answer is that if he lets it happen, then the principle behind it is he has a commitment to free will, and because he has a commitment to free will, he uses that as part of the justification for the thing happening. Whereas, if he does it on his own, it means free will is irrelevant. And the different side thing it will be that if it requires a commitment to free will for it to happen, and nobody makes the decision, it won't happen.